Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Kim Kindersley from Australia. He's the writer and director of the film Whale Dreamers. Right now, I would like to welcome Zuleika. She's the founder and director of the Story Dancer Project, and Coleman Barks, who is a poet and a translator of the work of Rumi, and he's joining us by telephone. And this is all in honor of a concert which is coming up called Rumi, A Wide Listening Sky at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe at 7:30 on Monday, October 20th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Coleman, let's talk to you first. You are a poet, you're a translator of the work of Rumi. Tell us briefly, who was Rumi?
Well, Rumi was a 13th century mystic who was born on the eastern edge of the Persian Empire and ended up in Konya, Turkey. And he was the head of a dervish learning community, and he was a great enlightened soul and a great artist. He was the unusual combination of an enlightened human being and an artist on the level of Shakespeare or Whitman.
That is, it's such an interesting combination, an artist and an enlightened person. The others who you mentioned, would you also consider them in that category?
I would, actually. They are not usually considered that. But I think Shakespeare was enlightened, and I think Chaucer was, and I think Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson were, too. But it's a difficult thing to define, yeah.
It is indeed. I mean,
it's what an enlightened being is. There are all different kinds, I think, of enlightenment. And
how did you get into
ecstatic. What?
He was a what?
He was an ecstatic human being.
What does
he
that
mean?
He
recognized and he knew that we all interconnect in a marvelous complex way, and that interconnection is something that we live within. It's a kind of an oceanic medium that we swim, and just knowing that and just being that is an ecstasy. Just having the ocean around us, he says, we fish, that's all we need to have is the ocean around us. and just feeling that is his insight.
How did you get into the work of translation? Although I guess it's not exactly translation that you do.
Well, it's collaborative translation with scholars who know the language.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you start doing that?
Well, in 1976, I learned from Robert Blyatt. I heard Rumi's name for the first time then when I was 39, and he thought that Rumi's poems needed to be taken out of the scholarly realm and put into the realm. They needed to be, in other words, be translated by a poet. And he thought that I was the one to do that. And so I began doing it. And as I began to do that work, I began to meet people and in dreams and in actual life. They gave me these marvelous friendships with which enabled me to actually do this work.
When you say in dreams and in actual life, what do you mean by the dreams part?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'd on May 2nd, 1977, I had a dream. It was a lucid dream. I woke up inside of it, and this ball of light came off of the Tennessee River where I grew up and where I was in the dream, and it clarified from the inside out. And there was a man sitting there in the ball of light, and he had a white shawl over his head, and he raised his head, and he said, "I love you," and I said, "I love you too," and the whole landscape then felt drenched with dew, as it would naturally be, but the dew in the dream was love, and it was just there was the whole world was filled with that love, and so. A year and a half later, I met that man that I'd met in the dream, and I say, you can believe that or not. I don't have the luxury of not believing it, because it happened to me. And so his name was Bawa Muhyiddin, a Sri Lankan Sufi. And he was the connection that I needed to understand what was going on in Rumi's poetry. And I sat in his room 4 or 5 times a year for 9 years until he died in 1987. And he's the only credential that I have, my friendship with him. But I don't know if this is the kind of thing you can talk about on the radio.
Well, we seem to be doing it.
We seem to be doing it, breaking new ground, yes. Anyway, so that's the main connection with that world that I needed to have to be able to approach this work at all. And I'm so grateful for that connection with him. Every time I work on these poems, it feels like I'm restored to his presence. And that's a great blessing.
We're talking to Coleman Barks, who's the translator of the poet Rumi. I imagine that you find that different poems speak to you, not only depending on what's happening in your own life, but also what's happening in the world around you. I wondered if you had any poems that you'd like to read or share with us that speak to the time that we're living in now.
I don't know about that, but I have. I was told to pick out 2 poems, and
any poem will do.
Okay, here's a short one. If you want what visible reality can give, you are an employee. If you want the unseen world, you're not living your truth. Both wishes are foolish, but you will be forgiven for forgetting that what you really want is love's confusing joy. That's a tough one.
So
well, maybe
a poem
not so
like,
tough.
A poem like that, where do you start with it? How do you work with it?
I just agree with it. I just say, yes, that's true. I thought I wanted things in the material world. I thought I wanted things in the spirit world, but really I just want to be in love. You know? Do you disagree with that, Mary Charlotte?
Oh, I'm just here to hear what you think.
Okay. Yeah, it's a daring thing to say. And, I don't usually read that one, but I just thought it would be a good one to read today.
You were talking
are much
about...
More,
go ahead, what?
Others are much more meditative and empty. He says, there is a desert. I long to be walking. A wide emptiness. Peace. Beyond any understanding of it. And certainly there is this longing in us for some kind of wide, empty. I love that the high plains of New Mexico. Something in me responds to them. And it is like a kind of solitude and a kind of peace. A wide emptiness, he calls it. Peace beyond any understanding of it.
You work with scholars who can translate from the original texts, and
right.
Then you, as a poet, work to sort of bring out the, what would you call it, the essence, the feeling, the truth of the language.
I just try to find language that is energetic and alive, and supposedly poets are supposed to be able to recognize that. When it occurs, and so know that when they have the phrasing right, that there is some kind of living texture to the words, and nobody knows quite what that is, or why some language is alive and some isn't. Some might be alive for you and not for me, but anyway, I just have to find the language that is alive for me.
What is the community of Rumi scholars like? I mean, scholars tend to like to analyze and categorize things. And it seems that Rumi's work really can't be contained in that way. I mean, you yourself called it oceanic. How do scholars deal with something that is just so much bigger than they are?
They have to... either his poems are lived, or they're not understood. In other words, they're not susceptible to be explicated or examined with the mind. They must be inhabited in some way. And the Rumi scholars are a good bunch. You know, they know that. It's true. The ones that I've met, William Chittick and Alan Godless and Anne-Marie Schimmel, they're glorious human beings, and they know that the talking about it and the being smart is not it. That somehow Rumi's poems are about a lived. If they're not lived, they're not. You can't get at them at all.
We're talking to Coleman Barks and Zuleika, who is sitting with us here at the table in the cafe. And I guess something that I wanted to ask you both, and you're speaking to this yourself, is just the question of how, in your experience, the continual, I guess you would almost call it a practice, of reading this poetry changes you. How does it get inside you? I wondered if you could address that, Zuleika.
Well, I think that Rumi speaks to the core of who we are, so people recognize this. And so every time I read a poem that I might be friends with from a long time ago, I'm in a different seat in myself, and it reminds me of some way to pay attention.
Did you say a poem that you might have been friends with a long time ago?
Yeah, I did.
Is that how you consider them?
Yeah.
What about you, Coleman? Do you consider the poems your friends?
I guess so, yeah. Or at least the words from a presence that is a friend.
It's like a reminder, you know, like some of the poems are, I tell people that they're maps of, because as Coleman said, Rumi was an awakened being. He left us maps of awareness that are funny or deeply heart-tearing or shocking or, that's true, I didn't think of that. And so it's like going to an acupuncturist for me. Like it puts a hand on a pulse in a place that I might have forgotten, or it opens into some place that I've been struggling with where there's a picture of something that can help me to be allowed to feel what this is.
Now, this is an event, the concert, which is on Monday, October 20th at 7:30 at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe, is called Rumi, A Wide Listening Sky. What is the significance of the title?
Well, one of his metaphors for the soul is that is an amazement, and that that wondering finds its image in a wide open sky as a kind of a limitless metaphor for identity. The Sufis love to say that what they're doing when they write poetry, or when they do the turn, or when they listen to music, it's some kind of a deep listening. The word sama means a deep listening. And it's a listening that opens the heart. That's what the work of it is. Whatever that mystery is, when your heart opens, that is what the Sufis are. That's what Rumi's after.
And you know, when we sit, when we all come together, this amazing group of people, Coleman, thank you for all the work you've done to bring these phrases and poems to life. And then we're joined with, this year, a fantastic Oud master, Rahim Al-Hajj, who has taken asylum, really, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's a very high-level classical musician from Iraq. And he's a Grammy nominee, and he's joining us, along with Glenn Velez, who's one of the most amazing world percussionists that we've ever met, and David Darling, a fantastic cellist, and all of us together in this weaving.
And you as a dancer.
And me as a dancer.
And storyteller.
Yes. Story dancer, I like to say.
Story dancer.
I mean, to come together in a collaboration rather than each person doing their thing is a very unique event. We like have a living room together, you know, and I think Coleman opens up the space with his voice, and then we all come in and we make this weaving together based on the feeling that we have of this poetry. And it, some of it's very funny and some of it's very deep. I mean, you were there last year, I think you can recall.
Yes, indeed. How long have you been doing this?
I don't know. Some time now, right, Coleman?
I think it's in the late 80s we started.
You've been doing this since the 80s. So you've been doing this
20 years, yeah.
20 years.
I think so.
Not that long. Maybe no? In between, I think around maybe 12 to 15. Something.
So, in other words, over a decade. So how do you make it different and new each year? Do you choose the poems obviously are the centerpiece of the Rumi's poems of the concert. How do you choose them, and then where do you go from there?
Well, we choose some of the old favorites, and then we usually choose a selection of new ones that we've never done anywhere.
And one thing we've found out is that every time is new. So we could do the same poem, but it's new. You don't hear it the same way in the moment where we are. So it makes it a lot of fun because it's sort of like, oh, I already know that. Oh, wow, I don't know that at all. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Even though I know that, I forgot to remember that.
Yeah.
So in terms of the music, to what extent are you working with music that would have been, authentic or contemporary in Rumi's time versus music that is freshly composed?
Well, we're trying to translate. So we're trying to translate it from 13th century Afghanistan or Turkey to 20th century, 21st century New Mexico. And so we translate the music gets translated too. It's not trying to be authentic to the 13th century culture and those instruments that they used, but they did use music to deepen and to let the poems go deeper.
And I think one of the interesting things about this experiment that we've been privileged to be part of is that it's a reflection of the time we live in. It's not trying to, as Coleman said, it's not trying to copy something that lived 800 years ago. There'd be no purpose for us. We're being ourselves in it and coming to life in the way that we're feeling this moment.
Now, you, Zuleika, are the founder of the Story Dancer Project, and you are doing a program in Santa Fe. This concert is, among other things, a fundraiser for that. Tell us about what's in the story program here in Santa Fe.
Yeah, What's in a Story is a program that we have. Now, we're an international artistic health resource program, which I really like because it means you can be an artist and be a resource. We don't have to have the answer, but I've developed a set of core wellness exercises, and now we have five facilitators working in three Santa Fe public schools with over 500 children, learning about stories and culture and bilingual. It's Spanish and English, and it's also a literacy program. But in between the program, the facilitators lead the children in these fun exercises that don't take very long, and so we keep the energy going. So the net proceeds, this isn't a benefit outright, but the net proceeds of this concert go to help this program because, as we all know, there's no money in the public schools, and we bring our programs free of charge to the places we serve. So.
What is the program that you're doing actually look like? How do you work with the young people?
Well, we go into a classroom and make magic.
You make it sound so easy.
It is so easy. But we go in with stories. I work with the facilitators, and we... I have to say that reading Rumi and having done this work with Coleman for a while has showed me something about essence. And so into the stories, which I tell stories and dance in the concert, I try to come at it from an essential point of view of what's really in the story, what's the message in the story, and pick stories that have some kind of teaching in them, because that's how I was trained in dancing. That teaching is mostly through humor, because that's fun. And so they go in with stories that we've worked on all together. They don't dance them. They read them, and they work with vocabulary words, but we bring it alive, and we all work together to do this. So it's a team effort. It's not my... I'm not even doing it most of the time. These other people are doing it now.
Coleman Barks, you are yourself a poet, and we get to hear a little bit of your work as well during the event. Tell us more about your work and how you draw on, I don't know if you can speak to that, but how you draw on the poet Rumi yourself.
Yeah, I don't know what the influence there is. I write about my own life. Usually I say when I try to work with Rumi, I get out of the way. You know, I try to disappear. But when I write my own poems, I just get in the way and let my own shame and my own wonder and my own joy come through. And so they're personal in a way that Rumi's poems are not. So this evening, Monday the 20th, will be mostly Rumi.
Zuleika, you have spoken about how this performance is a real union of music and poetry and dance. How long do you rehearse? I mean, how do you actually make that work?
I think, well, the grace is one way. I think that for me, when Coleman reads, it evokes a certain heart feeling. Yeah, you can hear in his voice there's a kind of resonance that happens. And then the way that we work is, well, a lot of us have done this a few times now together, and we work spontaneously. And yet we go through the poems, and Coleman tends to say what the flavor of the rhythm might be. I help to bring that out. And people, each musician, we find our way together. It's a collaborative, amazing process, and we never exactly know what it will be like.
This poetry, I think, speaks, as we sort of were starting to get at before, speaks to people at different times in their lives, but when times are rough, like now, how do you use poetry? How do you use Rumi's poetry?
Myself?
Yeah.
Well, I think that Rumi is such a fabulous template for right now, because he's talking about paying attention to the ocean of the heart in the midst of all of the circumstances, which is what we are really being asked to do right now. And so I think that gathering in a listening context for this concert is an opportunity for everybody to bring our hearts together, to listen to the greater love that we all need right now. It's not a religion, it's not a philosophy, it's a fact.
Coleman Barks, anything you would like to add before we go?
Well, I guess not. I just adore this poetry, and I like to be around people who have done a lot of inner work, you know. And when I read the poems to people like the group in Santa Fe, that seems to be very far along the path of growth, soul growth, then I begin to understand the poems better. When I read them to people like that, I love the audience in Santa Fe.
So this is, and it's usually a very packed audience. How do you, I mean, do you get your energy, Zuleika, from the response? I mean, obviously the audience is just sort of sitting there quietly.
Yeah, but they're listening deeply and loudly. And I think the fun of it is something that Coleman touched on about soul growth. I think Santa Fe attracts people who are seeking for the truth of their lives. And so when a lot of people come together in that way, it's really fun.
Zuleika is the founder and director of the Story Dancer Project, and Coleman Barks is a poet and translator of the work of Rumi. And they will be there at 7:30 on October 20th, Monday, October 20th, at the Lensic for a concert titled Rumi, A Wide Listening Sky. For more information and tickets, you can call the Lensic at 988-1234. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to introduce Kim Kindersley. He is the writer and director of the award-winning film Whale Dreamers, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Center. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hello there.
It's great to have you on the air. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your own story, how you left a successful career and a comfortable life and ended up in Australia involved with dolphins and whales and people from the Aboriginal Murning tribe.
Well, you know, it sort of goes into it a little bit in the film, but I was sort of merrily going along my way and living in London, being an actor, and going to auditions and appearing in TV series and films and adverts and plays and doing all that kind of thing. And I was sort of vaguely heading towards Hollywood, I suppose. I was just at that point of kind of breaking through, along with all the Hugh Grants and everybody. And I went on a trip to Ireland because that's where my family's from, and visited my uncles and cousins and so on. And I went to a fishing village called Dingle Bay, where I'd heard there was this lone hermit dolphin, which is a dolphin that leaves the pod and goes and hangs out with human beings. I was only intrigued. I mean, I just thought it would be a fun thing to do, but I had no expectation of anything dramatic happened. And how wrong was I? I mean, I went out on the ocean, and this dolphin came up to our boat and leapt out of the water, and I got into the water, and he swam very fast towards me, and it was freezing kind of Atlantic water, very murky, came very close to me and turned around and then looked at me with this eye of his. And it was just like this moment where everything that I'd been taught and the whole of my life completely changed in that moment, because I kind of felt I was one with everything, and that I hadn't really been taught that we live in balance with nature and that kind of thing. So it set me on a path to start seeking out mythologies around whales and dolphins. And obviously that led me to tribal people, firstly in America, actually with the Chumash Indians in California. And in fact, one of the first big dolphin events I ever went to was in Santa Fe in 1992. It was a dolphin symposium called together by Scott Taylor. And Francis Huxley was there, all sorts of extraordinary people. Anyway, eventually the trail led through Hawaii and then down to Australia, where there's a fellow here called Peter Shenstone, who had channeled in the 70s and 80s a thing called The Legend of the Golden Dolphin, which speaks of the end times and the time of the end of the system of things, which is now, and this dolphin spirit called Kui Long. And then that led me again to this tribe in the south called the Murning, who'd actually seen a promo video I'd put together with an actor friend of mine called John Hurt, because I was working on a film at the time called Eyes of the Soul with Julian Lennon. And then one thing led to another, and I became completely intrigued by their story because it was so human. Apart from all the magical stuff going on with the whales, they'd been declared extinct by the government in 1957. And there I was sitting with these amazing people on their land, in the, you know, it was very, very remote, and with these stunning whale rocks and this incredible culture around the whale, their totem animal, with beautiful songs, but just really only a slither of their culture remaining. And I thought, wow, this is a story that should be told to the world, because this is our story. You know, we're headed towards extinction if we don't wake up in time. So let's share this with the world. And they had a prophecy around the coming of a white whale called Jiddera, who's their creation spirit, came at the beginning of time and created the land and the sea and the air. And so we called together a huge group of indigenous people from all over the planet. And that was really the beginning of the film that you see now.
What does the term whale dreaming, the title of the film is Whale Dreamers, what is whale dreaming? What does that mean? It's a specific thing.
Well, it's a very big subject, the dreaming in Australia, but to put it in the simplest way that I can, it is a poetic way of interacting with your ancestors, your history, your environment, the cosmos, and through it, you find your place in it. And so, for example, talking of whale dreaming, the Mirning, who live by the coast, so they're coastal people, would have had a long history of sharing ceremony with the whales. They feel that they eat the same food, so they eat shellfish off the reefs while the whales are coming in to rest and feed and so on. And then they would sing with the whales, and they believe they came from the whales, that to the whales they would return. So it's a way, in a way, of sort of interpreting where you are in the universe. And also through the dreaming, you co-create the future. There's been a lot of kind of talk in the last few years and of the powers of manifestation. I suppose The Secret, in a way, is a film all about that. But the dreaming, and through the dreaming, is the way that you co-create with the whole of nature and the universe and the cosmos, in a way, what's going to happen next, taking into account where you live and from whence you've come.
And so when you have a group like the Mirning people who are displaced, they're taken away from the sea by the Australian government, are they robbed of their ability to participate in that activity, that dreaming?
Well, this is the really key question. And, for all people who are seekers of the truth, it's like for the Aboriginal people, they feel that it's really important to be on the traditional land because it kind of anchors you. And it's from that place that everything else kind of evolves. It's where you get your water, it's where you conceive, it's where you give birth, it's where you live your life, and you know the land so intimately. You know where the fruit is at certain times of year, you know where to go to get water when it's in the drought season, and so on and so on. You know which cave to go into when the stars are in a certain alignment, which will create a certain kind of energy in a ceremony. And if you take that away, which, of course, they were all displaced and they were sent to work as servants in a thing called what is now known as the Great Australian Silence. And it's a very familiar story all around the world, including the U.S., with Native peoples, First Peoples being displaced and sent away from their traditional hunting lands and so on. Then it does create a massive problem. But having said that, we also all know that inside of us is everything as well. And I think that this is a realization that's also happening, that the dreaming also exists within the heart of every human being. And you can also, in a way, connect with your land, even if you're not there in the heart. But essentially, for Aboriginal people, it's very, very difficult to practice culture because the culture is so interwoven from where you're from.
We're talking to Kim Kindersley about his film, Whale Dreamers. So you brought together indigenous people, indigenous elders from all over the planet to Australia. This is documented in the film. And they're all people who have a relationship of one kind or another to whales, to dolphins, to the sea. What was the purpose of the gathering?
It was a very natural process. At about the third visit I did with the Mirning onto their land, and each visit we went deeper into, for example, on the third visit we went to this whale graveyard, and along the south coast a lot of whaling stations. So one of the things that happened to the Mirning before they were declared extinct was they witnessed the massive slaughter of literally thousands and thousands of their sacred animals and could do absolutely nothing about it. And all the bones that were left over from the carcasses of the whales were stored in this one place. And gradually, you know, over the years, they would do ceremonies in each rib cage of the whale. I was so moved by the energy of this place and the sadness. And, you know, they were explaining to me that the whole of Western civilization was built on the back of killing whales, which is the most sacred animal, not only to them, but to the Zulus. The same in Zulu, the word for God and whale are the same word. And, you know, it's such a sort of indication of where our culture has come from in the last 200 or 300 years, since the Industrial Revolution just sort of blindly slashing and burning the whole planet to, you know, to so-called improve our civilization. And it was this moment that when they said, by the way, the white whale's been born, and this is a prophecy that we would start singing and dancing the whale songs again, and, you know, and bring the world back into balance, which is actually a very common prophecy with indigenous people. You could look at the white buffalo prophecies and the white whale, white dolphin, white ravens for the Haida people. And because I'd been around the world doing all of this research and had met a lot of elders and other indigenous people, I suggested, well, would you like me to try and, you know, raise the money and call some people in to bear witness to your return to this sacred space? And they charged me with that job, and for me and a couple of friends of mine, we started to try and raise the money to bring these indigenous elders from Hawaii and New Zealand, that was Pauline Tangiora, and various other people, including even Ua tribesmen from the Colombian jungles, who don't actually have a connection to the sea, but their story was so potent, and because they were living in a traditional way, it felt important that they could be there. And so we went about the task, and I think we were about 6 hours away from the deadline of having to raise the money to allow this to happen, and we still only had 30,000 of the 400,000 that we needed. And a dear friend of mine was in the house in Malibu and said, well, I really don't know what we're going to do about this, and went upstairs to meditate on the roof of the house. And at that moment, a red-tailed hawk flew down and picked up a rattlesnake, flew it right above her head, and she decided that she would fund the whole thing herself through the Foundation Heart Magic. And that's how the gathering actually ended up happening, and people came from all over the world, and of course, it's documented in the film.
Once this whole group gathering finally came together, one of the great ironies was that the Australian government would let the Murning people go back to their ancestral homelands that they'd been kicked off of, only under the condition that they promised not to do any kind of ceremony. What was that about? What did they think was going to happen?
It was one of the strangest things about the whole process. It's like, you know, you have people that flew in from all over the world. And then, you know, we're sitting with the traditional council of the group of people who represent the government and everything on the land that was the Murnings. And they said, sure, you can go down to the sacred space down there. But, as you rightly say, as long as there's no ceremony. Now, can you imagine? Can you imagine being with, you know, 80 indigenous people going to a sacred place and saying to them, sorry, no prayers, no this, no that, no offerings? So, of course, we got down there, and in fact, the first thing, the tobacco came out. People were doing it very discreetly under their breaths, and rattles were coming out, and, you know, and it was one of those things where actually it was going on. But then the thing that really, if you like, for me, cemented the beauty of ceremony, but also got us thrown off the place, was when Pauline Tangiora sent out a karanga, which is a prayer to the whale spirit. It was a really beautiful moment, but within about 5 minutes, the spokesperson for the Anangu came up to us and said, you've got to leave now. So we had to leave, and it was, so the whole thing was cut short. But it, for me, it shows, you know, it's very indicative of the times we're living in. I think that, you know, that the mainstream and the kind of power paradigm that's controlling the planet is very, very scared of us really reconnecting with nature and coming back into that absolutely true balance with the natural world. And for me, that's what was represented on that day, was the absolute magic and beauty of who we are when we're in our sort of our natural ceremonial ritualistic state with nature. And but anyway, we carry it in our hearts to this day, that moment.
It does bring up issues that are really fascinating to the viewer, which is, what is the effect of ceremony on the people who do it, on the world, on that reconnection? Are you actually moving greater energies around? I mean, there is a kind of mystical sense to it that, people who haven't experienced that themselves don't know quite what to make of it. How did you actually experience it?
It's a really good question, because it's so funny. Some people see the film, and I promise you, they don't. All of what you've just said completely goes over their head, and it's like they're kind of saying to me, "But where's the narrative? There's not enough narrative. I want to know more about what did they have for breakfast." And, you know, they want to know all the kind of really sort of surface stuff. Where as what you're describing is entirely experiential. And so, you know, for me to describe what it is or how it feels is difficult, because I suppose it's different for every person. But I can give you a little, I try and give you an understanding of it from my perspective anyway. I mean, I've done a lot of ceremony with the Elko people. And so it starts off where you're creating sacred space, so you're purifying yourself with smoke, with the leaves in the fire, and that's sort of clearing your energetic field, if you like, of anything that shouldn't be there. And so you're then entering into the sacred space, which could be a circle, and you're setting an intention. And again, to put it in terms of, you know, the power of manifestation, I don't think human beings understand just how powerful we are when we really set an intention. Which is why, you know, on the surface, everything may look hopeless out there, you know, with what's going on in the world. But actually, it's not at all, because if enough of us can wake up to the reality of who we are, we can change this paradigm so fast, so quickly, just by intending it, just by pure intention in the heart. So for me, when we go into ceremony, and, you know, and I can be in a kind of, oh, I'm a bit tired, I've been working on this for years, I don't really feel like it on the day. But the moment it starts happening and you hear the sacred songs, because that's often a part of ceremony, chanting, and you realize that the chants have been sung by the Aborigines maybe for 60,000 years. And so something comes in, and, you know, a greater force comes into the circle of people. And then you just get goosebumps all over your body. You feel your heart opening. And you also feel completely at one with everybody, even though there are people there whose languages you don't speak, or their cultures you don't know or understand. It's in that space that some really serious magic happens. And I think that the fact that we're even having this talk on the radio, for me anyway, indicates, you know, well, what were we doing on that bite for that week? With all of those people doing those ceremonies, was it just for us? Did it have any effect in the world? Well, it is having an effect in the world, because people are watching the film and raising questions just like the one you just did. So for me, look, we haven't made billions of dollars at the box office, and we live in a horribly commercial world where seemingly the only thing that's important is the bottom line and money, where in fact it's the least important thing. And the most important thing, in my view, is what we're talking about, which is real, which is magical, which is our birthright, which goes beyond all the religions. And it's in that space that I believe the hope lies for humanity.
We're talking to Kim Kindersley. The film is called Whale Dreamers. I felt when I was watching it, and I don't know if this was just me or not, but I felt that there was kind of a tension between the depth of the subject, which you're talking about now, namely the deep connections among people and animals and the earth and the ocean on the one hand, and then the very different pace and feeling of making a documentary and dealing with money and cameras and crews and and fundraising, and then I look at the website, and there's these like little cute blonde starlets advertising the film, and it just seems like there's that attention there. How do you, is that true? How do you work with that?
Oh, you know, hey, that's another whole subject, but look, it's out there now, but no, it's unbelievable. It's beyond belief, the particularly the money side of it. It's so hard to get anybody to commit to something like this because they're worried that it's not going to make money, that there isn't an audience and all the rest of it. And so that was a constant challenge, but we were incredibly lucky in having, firstly, the person that put up the money for the gathering through a non-profit, who really put her money where her heart is, which is fantastic and rare. And then we had Julian Lennon, who, you know, John's son, who has a little bit of personal wealth, obviously, and he again felt that it was really important, knowing that, you know, the typical corporate media would not get behind something like this. And so he started to bankroll it. Unfortunately, he didn't realize how long it would take us. And it did end up costing, you know, well over $1 million. But most of it was just blood, sweat, and tears. You know, long hours in the studio with editors and people doing deferred fees. And, I mean, I can't even tell you, just incredible people, cameramen, and who gave their time, and just communities who put on events and gather, you know, just it. There are no words to describe the amazing amount of input from so many people. And then, of course, you get to the end of that particular cycle, and then you try and get distribution. And then that's another whole story where the doors are just closed. Oh, sorry, we had a documentary in here last week with Leonardo DiCaprio called 11th Hour. It didn't do very good numbers, so we're just not going to do it. We've got, don't worry, we've got plenty of comic book superhero movies coming out where they go and kill lots of baddies, you know, who happen to be Middle Eastern or whatever it is. But, you know, it's deeply depressing, the movie industry, and a very, very poor reflection on who we are, I think. Very, very sad story. But look, we keep chipping away, and, you know, the more projects like this that can be made, in my view, I believe it's really important. And on that note, there's a fantastic company in America called Monterey Media. You know, they saw the film, they realized that it had some depth, and they, you know, courageously took it on. And said, I can't say enough good things about them, actually. They're an amazing group of people. They really care, and they make huge effort. And that's why I'm talking to you today. If it wasn't for them, you know, we'd be sort of straight to DVD and just selling from the website. So,
that's right.
You know, there are a few people out there that care. And, of course, the other great group is the Spiritual Cinema Circle. They're a fantastic organization. And you probably know others as well that are doing great work in this area. So there's plenty of hope here.
Kim Kindersley is the writer and director of the award-winning, many, many award-winning film, Whale Dreamers, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Center. You can find out more about it at whaledreamers.com. Thank you so much for being with us, Kim Kindersley, on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
And listen, thank you so much for having me, and I do hope that the listeners, have fun when they go and see the film, and look forward to getting some feedback and coming to Santa Fe again soon.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.